Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2019. Lecture 7, delivered on February 11, 2019. The title of this lecture is Time Value of Money.
Today, the time value of money. I begin with a completion of work that I did on the last time we had together when we were looking at the financials of Target Corporation. Now, this worksheet should be available to you in ReggieNet. It is more or less the comprehensive set of financial ratios that we do in basic finance. And these are the ones that they would probably ask you about, or I would be asking about in the homeworks. And possibly more, you would do in the midterm exam, you might do a few calculations, but more you would be interpreting what you see. So as I'm going through a few of these, I want to point out what they mean and how we interpret them. So for example, as I had begun this the last time, I was looking at, for example, gross margin. In this case, the gross margin on Target for 2000, the latest reporting year, is 0.2887. Now, what that means is that's 28.87. I'm sorry, is that right? Yeah. So in other words, what we're saying with the gross margin, which is the sales divided by the gross profit, that one right there, or gross profit divided by sales, I'm sorry. This is how much of every dollar the company takes in the cash register that survives the wholesale cost of the goods that they sold. So in this case, what we are saying with Target is that in 2017, for every dollar they took in, they paid out $1 minus 29 cents. So they paid out about 71 cents in wholesale costs. Or the other way of saying that is they were able to keep 28.87, or about 29 cents of every dollar. So that is not spectacular. That's a pretty steep wholesale cost structure that they are enduring. But it's theirs, and as you can see, it's eroded a little bit from year previous when it was a little over 29 cents, 29 and a quarter cents, down below 29 cents for this year. So their wholesale costs have gone up against their retail. Now, why would that be? Why, sir, would you not just keep your retail costs, your retail sales, your retail prices directly in line with your wholesale costs? Well, be specific with me. That was a very non-answer. Okay, you're a business person. Your cost just went up by 20%. So are you going to jack your prices up by 20%?
Probably.
You will. Go ahead.
I think you'd jack them up more because you're still trying to make product.
Say that again.
I think
you'd
jack up the price more because you're still trying to make a product out of that product.
What would keep you from doing that? They obviously didn't do that. They did the opposite. Oh, who said that?
Me.
Oh, a bunch of people got to. So in other words, if you've got fierce competition, you might not be able to reflect all of your increases in wholesale costs at the retail level. You might be caught. That's where we get into that thing in economics about price elasticity of demand. There comes a point where if you jack up your price, obviously, always when you bring up your prices, you lose customers. The question is, how many customers do you lose versus how much do you increase your revenues by bringing up your price? In this case, it looks like they are having a they have a little bit of competition that's keeping them from directly matching percent for percent wholesale retail prices against wholesale costs. So we want to keep an eye on that. It's relatively minor. I'm not too worried about it. We're going to look at that more deeply here in a few minutes, how significant it was. But for the time being, we do recognize that this is a company that has some resistance to price increases to match their wholesale price cost increases. Now, net margin. Operating margin. That is how much of every dollar that came into the cash drawer that survived not just your wholesale costs, but all your other costs, like your lights, your salaries, your other costs that go in. So, in other words, in Target's case, they kept about 6 pennies of every dollar by the time they had paid all their normal bills, their wholesale costs, their suppliers, their salaries and wages, their light bills, their computer costs and all of that, their advertising, their marketing, 6 cents. And that has eroded even more significantly from above 7 cents year previous down to 6 cents. So we see that there is erosion. Their costs are becoming a little bit more aggressive relative to their ability to bring in dollars to the cash register. Net margin. Interestingly, this one, that's almost an insignificant. So at the bottom line, they were able to hold on to 4 pennies of every dollar, and those 4 pennies belong to the shareholder. Those 4 pennies are what the shareholder kept of every dollar that came into the drawer. The rest of the money went to pay bills of one kind or another. So in a case like this, now is that a great margin, net margin, or a bad net margin? Can't say exactly because we'd have to see what's typical in the industry. And the problem is that typical in this industry is a little bit complicated. Target is actually an easy company. To the extent that they have one line of business. Retail like Walmart, Target, Giant Eagle, Costco, those kinds of companies, they are in one business and one business only. In other industries, it gets to be a real question. What the heck is their industry? What do we compare them to as far as other comparable companies? But here it's not bad. ROE. Return on equity is the net income divided by the equity of the company. Return on ROE is the net income divided by the common stockholders' equity. This is a measure of how, given what the stockholders have invested, that's the denominator, how much did they make at the bottom line? In this case, it's 4 cents divided by whatever their stockholders' equity is. And in this case, that would be about 25 cents. Not much difference from one year to the next. The next one is return on assets, ROA, which is equal to, and then we're going to go over here to the balance sheet. We're going to go over here to the balance sheet, if I can find it. Really? Did I miss it? There it is. No. You know, this is what really sucks. I have to go. Oh, there it is. There, consolidated statement of year. Okay, I see. Okay. Divided by total assets. Oops, I didn't do that right at all. Okie dokie, let's stop that again. Let me do that over again because I was searching too long for that. Equals the net income of the company, consolidated statement of operations. Oh, I see what I did. I didn't. Okay, go on down. Come on. Net earnings right there. Divided by the... And again, I'm going to be looking around here. Statement of operations. There it is. Ask total assets. And then I'll do it for the year previous by simply, because the columns are lined up correctly in the back sheets. These, by the way, are percentages. If you think of a company, all the company's buildings, its shelves, its all of that, its inventory, its accounts receivable, all those things that make a company, that's like a portfolio of investments. This measures what the return on that portfolio is. In this case, it's 7.5% was the return on that portfolio of physical and human capital assets. Is that spectacular? By the way, always ROE will be above ROA. By how much, we can't really say too well. But there is something I need to bring up at this point. Getting these numbers away for just a minute. One's my dead one. This one's my live one. Return on equity is equal to net income divided by total shareholders' equity. And then ROA is equal to net income divided by total assets. Typically, the higher this number, these two numbers are, the better. Okay? And especially, there is a lot of focus on the return on assets, ROA, of a company. Got to get that higher. Get it up there. 5% isn't good enough. 7%, not good enough. Let's get that ROA up there. In other words, how much is that portfolio of assets turning into money for the shareholders, money for the company? The problem is that many companies, many stories are out there of how that ROA can go up and up and up until the company collapses. You see, if you keep pushing your assets to greater and greater productivity per unit of the assets, per dollar of assets, you can get net income to go up or at least stay fairly stable. The trick here is that you can make total assets go down. They go down naturally by depreciation on the balance sheet. Look. Your fixtures and equipment, your land, your buildings, you are depreciating those. The accountants are depreciating those year over year over year. So unless you are reinvesting and buying new assets at a faster rate than your current assets, your existing assets are being used up, depreciated, the total asset line will either go up very slowly or it could go down relative to net income. I fire half of my employees, and you are all left, so you just all have to double your productivity for me. Work, work, you slave. Work, you dog. Just push the assets that you have harder and harder. And many are the stories of how that turns into a disaster. Here in the United States, in the 1970s, the refineries, oil refineries, were built along the Gulf Coast. And if you go out there, you'll see some of those in Texas itself. Refineries were built, other parts of the country, oil refineries. And then no more were built. In the 80s, the 90s, and the first decade of the 21st century, they didn't put any more, build any more refineries. They just made the refineries that they had do more, crack more hydrocarbons down to gasoline, distillates like jet fuel and diesel fuel. They just worked them harder and harder. They didn't put in any maintenance into them. They just worked them. And, of course, what that meant was that over time, the depreciation on those existing refineries caused total assets of these oil companies to go downward. But, of course, they were being pushed harder and harder to produce more oil at higher prices, so net income was going up. So when the numerator goes up and the denominator goes down, you get ROAs that were looking better and better every year. It was just absolutely gorgeous. Until the refineries got so old that they started exploding, killing not just workers, but killing people in the communities near where the refineries were operating. It was one of those, they were ignoring the long-run consequences of driving their ROA up. We watch cautiously when companies refuse to make their total assets go up, because they think that just by squeezing their existing assets harder and harder, they can make more income with fewer assets. And in the end, that is a fool's game. But sure enough, companies still do it to this day. They will get rid of assets and then make the assets that remain just work harder and harder until suddenly they break. When you have these companies that just get shocked, because unions start to step in, well, there's a reason the workers aren't happy, because you got rid of half of them and you're making the others work like slaves. Oh, that's how dare you talk against capitalism. No, this is what capitalism can do when you're using it the wrong way. You're not using capital. You're squeezing capital too hard, and yeah, you can make ROA go up all you want. But at the same time, you're going to have a real problem. Another thing is, and I'll show you this, I'll probably show you this on Wednesday. You can make ROE go up in a very dangerous way. And most companies do it. It's good to do it for a little bit, but if you push it too hard, you're going to get some real bad consequences out of it. Now let me get back to the dashboard here. Coming back over here to these, the dividend ratio. This says how much of every dollar that belongs to the shareholders. Oh, thank you. Greatly appreciate it. How much of every dollar that belongs to the shareholders is given back to them as a dividend? The dividend ratio. Dividends per share divided by net income per share. Now, this one can be a little bit trickier. I'm going to come back here and see if we can see the dividend per share right here. Don't see it. So what I'll have to do is you have to kind of prowl around a little bit for this one. Statement of retained earnings will have it. Common stock, preferred stock, shares, they're shares outstanding. I might have to do it that way if they're not going to be cooperative. Oh, I should see it on this one. Where is the dividend per share? I could go over here to Target's current dividend. Oh, dividend. Okay. 1338. That's the total dividend paid. Ooh, they had a heavy repurchase of stock. So what I'll do here is I'm going to do the total dividend paid, 1.1338, come back over here. Okay. Dividend ratio. Okay, that will equal, and I'm going to go over here to that statement of cash flows. I should also be able to see it in the statement of retained earnings, too. But there's that. Okay, cash provided, other dividend paid. Okay, equals dividend paid divided by, and you cruise back here. And you'll notice that I actually have to dig around because they're not in a good order and I didn't get that taken care of. Oh, come on. There we go. Net earnings divided by net earnings. Okay, why do you keep criticizing me every time I have to search for something? Let me do this. Try it one more time. Equals dividend per share, dividends. Find that dividend again, statement of cash flow. Dividends, total dividends, come on, dividends, equals, okay. Dividend paid, that, divided by, and then go back here to the earnings. Keep looking. Net earnings. And that's a negative. I should have put an absolute value on that. But the dividend, it shouldn't be a negative, so I'll just put a negative on it. Target in the current year, or 2017, I should say, paid out for every dollar that it earned that belongs to the shareholders, it gave the shareholders back 46 cents of that dollar in dividend. Saying that another way, you can say there's the plowback. Which is a dollar minus what they gave. Whoops, try that again. Equals one minus the dividend ratio. There we go. So their dividend ratio has gone down somewhat, and their plowback ratio has gone up from 51 cents to 54 cents. However, this is a very generous dividend. This company is giving back to its shareholders about 46 cents of every dollar it earns for them. Put another way, of every dollar that belongs to the shareholders, Target is putting back into the company only 54 cents. Now, of course, a company that has no dividend, that pays no dividend, has a dividend ratio of zero and a plowback ratio of one. The more a company pays out in dividends, the less money it has to reinvest in the company. Now, very quickly, looking at Target, Target, this is incorrect. Well, maybe it's not. That's a little bit odd. This is a company that is just basically behaves like the market. It is not a high growth company. It's not. It won't grow fast because it plows most of its money out to its shareholders. It does not put it back into the company. Take that as opposed to a company like Netflix. NFLX. Netflix gives its shareholders none of what it makes. It gives them none. It takes every dollar that it makes and plows it back into the company. Notice that that makes its beta higher because the shareholders have no check in the mail. Everything that will happen as far as their wealth increase investing in Netflix comes through the ability of the executive management and the directors to take the dollars that belong to the shareholders and turn them into more dollars for the shareholders. Notice that that's also reflected in that insanely high P/E ratio. Investors are willing to pay huge $129 for $1 the company has earned. For every dollar that the company has earned, investors think that Netflix will turn that into $129 because every dollar is completely plowed back into the company with Netflix. With Target, which is a more stable company, a more mature company, you're not going to see this company make you insane profits on capital gains because it's not putting the dollars of the shareholders into the company again at a rate nearly as aggressively as high growth companies do. Moving along here, and you'll want to listen to this podcast, I promise, because I'm saying an awful lot. And in a way, it doesn't sound like I am, but I am. Okay, now, let's go down here. I got these. Now, liquidity ratios. Liquidity ratios simply measure liquidity. The first one is current assets divided by current liabilities. And let me do that one. And I'll break that one down to here. Current. That is going to be the companies and, you know, I ought to just rearrange these so that I've got the ones I want right where I want them. Okay, current assets divided by total current liabilities. That's interesting. Now, let's take it, drag it over. The current ratio has gone up a modest amount, about 1.2%. This is the measure of the company's ability to pay what it owes within a year with what it will sell or bring in revenue from in a year. That's what the current ratio measures. In this case, you could say it two ways. One way is in 2017, Target was able to pay its current bills, was able to pay 95% of its current bills with what it has currently in assets that could be liquidated within a year. That's basically what it's saying. Now, this can be all over the board, and it also has to do with the cash management policy. There's an old mythical rule, and I don't think they're even teaching it anymore, in at least here, that your current assets should match your current liabilities. Maturities of assets should match maturities of liabilities. That's not true. Some companies have considerably higher current assets than current liabilities. Some companies have very thin current assets. They finance everything long term or finance a lot of it long term. In the case of Target, it pretty much matches the current assets to the current liabilities. Now, the next one that is of use to us is the acid test, which is also known as the quick ratio. Quick ratio, put in your notes, quick ratio is the same as the acid test. Now, the acid test works like this, on this logic. Your current assets are those assets that should be able to be liquidated within a year. Okay? Inventory is, if you had to unload your inventory, all of it within a year, you're probably not going to be able to get what the book value of it is. You're going to find that a lot of your inventory, if you needed to get money out of it real fast, you'd be selling it at fire sale prices. I told you about the story of my company. I have an enormous inventory. It's staggering how large it is. But could I get rid of that all at the prices in a year? When I'm talking about things from $200 on up to $2,000, there's no way I could sell that all in a year. Matter of fact, most of it I won't sell in my lifetime. Then you can buy it at a discount when people raid my storage unit. But the quick ratio simply says, all right, let's take the current assets, open parenthesis, and total current assets, and subtract out the inventory. And then take that number divided by the current liabilities. It should be lower, yeah. Taking out the most illiquid of the liquid assets, inventory, Target could pay its current liabilities only 30% or 30 cents of every dollar of its current liabilities with its current assets. So in other words, Target is heavily vested in current assets that aren't all that liquid. This is a company that has a very significant inventory. And inventory is great for some reasons, but it's also bad in other reasons. Madam, why is inventory good?
Because it's better for them to have more money. Or is it supplies?
That's what you've got in the warehouse that you can put, that's going to go on your shelves. That's inventory.
Just they can make more money by selling more supplies?
Supplies. I mean, they're goods, they're products.
Yeah.
You see, when you've got inventory, you can actually get it onto the shelves faster. You, sir, went to Target looking for a high-quality Instapot. You know, have you seen an Instapot? They're sort of like a Crock-Pot, but they can do excellent. They make beef so tender, it's just... Anyway, okay, you have... Your shelves have no Instapots. They're very popular, they're bought out. Now, what happens if you cannot, as soon as you see that there's none there on your shelves, what is your first thing that you would want to do? No, you are our Target, for God's sake. You're not going to buy from... You're the people in the company, in Target. What are you going to do? Well, you'll get it off your own inventory shelves. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, and if they don't have it in the back, go to our warehouse. If we don't have our warehouse, call the damn company and get some to us. You see, with inventory, you can rapidly replace depletion. Okay, that's important. You can rapidly replace what's on your shelves. You will notice that some companies aren't very good at that. Look at Walmart. You'll notice empty places on shelves. That is, they don't have the inventory where they can get to it very quickly. Now, the downside, though, of inventory is that it is actually, inventory is an opportunity cost, and it's a direct cost. You have to have warehouses, okay? Wonderful. You have to have the ability to move stuff from those warehouses to the shelves. That's wonderful. And you've spent money on the inventory, and until you sell it, you don't have any money from it. So there's that cost of the time, that time value of the money that you put into inventory between when you bring it to your warehouse and when you actually get it to a cash register, a customer gets it to a cash register. That's the, so it's a double-edged sword. Different companies have different ways. There are some companies that do something close to what's called just-in-time, where a product is made only at the point when it is needed. And then there are some companies that just keep very large amounts of inventory ready to go to the customers when it's needed. Now, if you are to talk about Target, that's actually a fairly aggressive inventory they have. They keep their shelves full. A secondary part of that is that inventory... We oftentimes think of inventory as what's in the warehouse. But inventory is what is also on the floor of your store as well. There's an old saying that it won't sell if it ain't on the floor. So that's why you will see these companies just pack their stores. Especially there are so many aspects to it. This is probably not an appropriate question, but I'll ask it hell anyway. Sir, do you shop for women's clothes? Have you ever accidentally walked through the women's section at an apparel store or a general store?
Yeah,
I do too. It's an accident. Now, you notice how the clothing is very tightly. You have to actually, in some stores, walk sideways to go between the racks. That partly is because they've got to get that, all of that that they buy. It does nothing for them if it's in a warehouse. They need that out where you can see it. And there's also another reason, too. It works in another nice way, because the closer those circular racks are together, the more likely you're going to have to squeeze between them, and then you're going to feel the material. You're trying to get between, oh, that's nice, yeah. I looked at a cashmere sweater in Von Mars. It was excellent, but, you know, that's just me. But there's the other side of it, is you want to pack those shelves right there on the floor, because the reality is that for every one item you sell in apparel retail, you will probably have anywhere from 10 to 20 that will never sell. Your sales ratio is staggeringly low. So you've got to get a lot on those shelves to sell a little. HSM, do any of you shop? Have you been to HSM? Okay. You ever heard of it? It's a massive British retailer, apparel retailer. And they've got a store here in town is now, too. Have you ever been there? Oh, is it HSM? Am I saying that right? H&M. HSM. Gee. Ooh, that Alzheimer's is really working on me now. H&M. Okay. They announced that they have unsaleable inventory, their current unsaleable inventory. What they've put on the shelves that never sold, $4.8 billion. They have to do that, though, because we are so finicky, so picky, that we are not going to buy unless it is our size, unless it is our color, unless it is the right season, unless it is the right mojo. So it really, really, that inventory number can be killer for a retailer of apparel that has an apparel aspect to it. That's one of the things that you'll see with a store like this. Target puts a lot of clothing, mostly women's, on its shelves, knowing very well that only a small fraction of that will ever go off the shelves. Even on clearance, it won't. So what happens to that stuff? It ends up being sold to buyers who put it into secondary stores. Stores that buy inventory that didn't sell at main stores. Can you think of any stores that do that? Oh, there you go. TJ Maxx, Marshalls. They are the ones who absorb that. They buy it at pennies on the dollar from the primary retailer, and the retailer does that because it just has to get rid of it. It can't keep it on the shelves forever. So that's a quick ratio. Goodness. A mother's work is never done. Now, this one is not in the book, and you won't see it in books anymore. This one is old school. It's called the burn ratio. Now, the burn says, okay, let's look here at the current assets. See these current assets? This other current assets is prepaid expenses, stuff like that, and accounts receivable. The reality, though, is that if push came to shove and you had to pay all of your current liabilities right away, there's only one thing that really matters. Okay, madam, the zombie apocalypse has come. You're in your house, okay? Now, in your house with you are your cowering relatives. Now, the zombies come to the door. So, you tell everyone, grab some stuff off the shelves. Grab the crackers. Grab the Spam. Toss the dog. And they're still, There's only one thing they want. What is that? You don't know? Haven't you ever watched a zombie movie? There's only one. Brains. So the only thing that matters is tossing your relatives out the door, because they just weren't satisfied with the dog brain, because it's a dog, for God's sake. It's got a small brain. It eats its own crap. Okay, so You see, this is the same thing with a company. If there were a fire sale, you had to pay your current liabilities right away. There's one thing and one thing only that matters. That's your cash. Cash and marketable securities. Cash and cash equivalents. Whatever you want to call it. So the burn ratio, all it does is say, okay, equals, go right back over here and just take the cash divided by the current liabilities. That number actually should not be very high. You see, the more money you have in cash, the less money you have invested in assets that will make money for you. Cash is not a money-making asset. Liquidity can be too high. In this case, I'm actually a little surprised. Their burn ratio is actually pretty robust at 20%. In other words, they could pay 20% of their current liabilities just with the cash they have on hand. That's kind of odd. Let's see how that works out. It is going up. It's almost irrelevant. Okay, but anyway, those are the liquidity ratios. And I just want to take you through as many of these as I can. Debt ratios. The debt to total assets is called leverage. Debt to total assets. And I do this while you're watching because it's better than just throwing the whole sheet at you and having you say, figure it out. I want you to see me do it. Debt to total assets is called leverage. How much of this company is debt as opposed to ownership? And all you do is you take your total debt divided by your total assets. And now there are a couple of different ways you can do that. Typically to do this, we will take only their long-term debt because that's the one that is their burden. It's going to be with them for a long time. Your total, equals that divided by total assets. So this company is about 29% debt. Dragging it over, it's stayed fairly stable. It's gone down a little bit. Here's the thing about debt. Debt is wonderful because it actually magnifies return on equity. That is what is called the gains to leverage. The more you use debt, the stronger your sales will be on the owner's position. And I'm going to show you gains to leverage, and I will be showing you how you can become a millionaire, how other people have become millionaires. What I won't probably tell you about is how many other people have become poor beyond their wildest dreams doing this trick. But it's how it's done, how many of these people who are alleged geniuses have become wealthy, incredibly wealthy. But anyway, this company is actually, that's a fairly low leverage ratio. You'll see companies with 70, 80% on this son of a dog. So now the other one is times interest earned, which I mentioned. And by the way, I'm going to put this sheet up on ReggieNet for you once I've finished it so that you'll actually have a model. Now, the times interest earned is how many times over the money the company has to pay its interest, it can pay its interest. So what we do is we take that equals. Now, we're going to go to the income statement to do this one. Seriously, why can't I find? There it is. Okay. Net interest. This is your operating margin. Is this what I want? Where the hell is our operating margin? Did I delete that? I can do it. I mean, I don't see an operating margin here. I don't see an operating income. Okay, I'm going to have to put in a line right here. Oh, earnings. There it is. Wow. Right there. Earnings from continuing operations. No, earnings from before, EBIT. Man, sometimes that's hard to do. Divided by how much interest they pay. Oh, yeah, you're just going to be all upset because I stopped and looked around for a little while. Just irritates the hell out of me. Okay, let's try it again. Equals the EBIT that divided by the interest. So this company can pay its interest that it owes about 6.5 times over with the money it has right before it pays interest. So in other words, right before the company target pays its interest expense, it has about 6.5 times that much to pay the interest. Now, that's very good. You don't want, if it ever falls, and this is a good question for an exam. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. If the times interest earned falls below 1, the company is in default. It has not been able to pay, and it is then right on the verge of bankruptcy. Because if you don't pay your interest expense to your debt holders, they can shut you down. They'll turn you off. There was a news article that was a little bit interesting this morning. There are two very large Chinese companies, two, that did not pay their interest expense, their interest payment on their bonds this current year. That is actually a little surprising. In other words, they are right now technically in default, and they have got to figure out very quickly how to get the money together to pay their lenders their interest, or those lenders will simply take them in and turn them off, shut them down. And these are two heavy Chinese companies in China. They have operations and sales around the world. And here in the United States, it's more or less just a matter of, okay, you go bankrupt and your company is taken away from you. In China, I don't know, maybe they shoot them or what, I don't know. Interestingly enough, notice that Target's times interest earned has strengthened greatly. In other words, last year, the 2016, they were able to pay their interest payments 5 times over with the money they had to pay interest payments. This year, 6.5 times over. So that's the good news. Now, moving just down a couple here. Asset activity. Now, I'd have to really dig for this one. I'm not going to do this one because I'd have to find their accounts receivable. And you remember on that balance sheet, they didn't break out the accounts receivable. Look, that's one unfortunate thing about Target is they clump. Used to be you had to show every line. See, it's somewhere there in other current assets. Do you see it? But they lump them all together, so I can't see the receivables directly. They're probably somewhere else in there, but I'm not going to go trying to find those things. And anyway, let me come back over here, dashboard. Inventory turnover. Inventory turnover. This is how many times over in a year the company completely used the inventory and got new inventory. So sales over inventory. So what we would do is, I'm going to do that one, inventory turnover. And that will equal your sales divided by your inventory. Target last year, 8.3 times, more than 8 times, it sold everything in its warehouse and on its shelves and got new in, on average. Now, obviously, it didn't have the shelves just completely wiped out, and then they put it on. But overall, Target was able to rotate its inventory 8 times. That's about once every month and a half. All of its inventory was replaced with new inventory. And then that's fairly stable. That's actually quite stable, inventory turnover. Now, the faster you turn over inventory, the better, technically. I mean, to the point where just in time, your inventory turnover is infinity, where you're producing a product as it is bought or as it is needed. However, there's a cost to higher and higher inventory turnover ratio. One of the costs that, okay, higher inventory turnover ratio means that you can have smaller warehouses, save space. Higher inventory turnover is also on the dark side. You have to really, really have strong production ability to keep the inventory moving off the shelves and new inventory moving onto the shelves. You've got a lot more in terms of delivery costs and all of that, the higher the inventory turnover. So it's controversial, even though a lot of people say it's not. Now, the next one I'm going to pull out here is your asset turnover, sales over total assets. Equals, go get your sales, divided by your total assets. $1.84. This one's a little harder to explain. It's how many times you would have, in a theoretical way, have used up all of your assets and brought a new pile of assets online. That's about the only way you can explain it. The higher this is, supposedly the better. However, I caution you with the story I gave you before. You can increase your asset turnover ratio by not replacing your assets, just letting them burn up, depreciate away. And so I'm not impressed when this is too high. And these are, okay, I'm going to do one. Price earnings ratio I've talked about. I'm going to do market to book and explain something. Normally, I am not thrilled about book values. However, in this case, I would want the market value of Target per share. The total market cap, I'll use 36,607. Divided by what the accountants say it is. Find that balance sheet. And that would be total shareholders' investment. In Target's case, market to book is about 3 times. The book value is what the original investment was, whether it was through selling stock or through getting money to the bottom line in retained earnings. It was the original value of the money. The market of the investment. The market value is the current market value of the investment. So you think about this as almost like a multiplier. Target has turned original money into market value 3 times over. You are my son. You really did give me a good look. That you went really gray there, bro. Okay. I spent $250,000 on you. Well, you're all grown up now, and the present value of your future expected earnings is $1 million. That would be a market to book of 4. You understand? It's sort of like how far the company has come from its birth, basically. And you'll see these market to books that are under one. In other words, it's fallen flat on its face. But on the other hand, you'll see some market to books that are just staggering. I did one, I wish I could remember what it was. It was last semester. I pulled a market to book that was over 20. That was just like, real. What did they do to do that? That was pretty impressive. But now, one last thing I want to show you on this is that once you do these, I want you to insert a row. And then you do the end, open parenthesis, end minus beginning, close, divided by the beginning value. And you get the change from year to year. And you can just drag this down. You'll get a couple of errors here. You see it? Isn't that interesting? This tells you how much change has happened in the ratios. And really, what we care about is changes. So I can see that their gross margin has gone down by 1.4%. ROE has gone up by a paltry amount. So you see, in our business, we really don't care about the numbers. We don't really even care too much about the ratios. What we care about is how these numbers are changing from year to year. Notice that in most of the cases of Target, you see that the changes are under a percent or a percent. That is a sign of a very stable, mature company. Go ahead. Yes.
Do you also use it to see if it's overvalued?
No. There's no such thing as overvalued. You're trying to be a day trader. You need to not do that in this class. Because I will take you to New York City and I'll show you why day traders are how Wall Street players have their next martini. Okay? There is no overvalue. You don't look at overvalue. Book value is just a number. Under and overvalue has no meaning. In real finance, we take a lot of time to get that so that we can sell it to suckers, the concept of overvalued and undervalued, because we've got to get rid of our bad stock on someone, so we tell people like you that it's undervalued, and then you believe us. Hang on here. We'll get on to all that later. We're going to do something right now. I have a brief quiz for you to do, and then when you're finished with it, you can leave.